我是 Wack 咖喱舞台和足球频道的主持 Chip 叻。恭喜 Wack 先挨过二、三、四年，成为香港少数第五年都还未执笠的网台。恭喜恭喜。
好，大家好啊！咁啊，嚟到呢个有趣嘅特别节目啦。咁咧就系杰斯频道同埋 Regis 先咧联播嘅。咁啊，阵间解释下点解有个咁有趣嘅安排。咁啊，先抱歉啦，因为我今日就大感冒，所以咧把声都十分之差嘅，咁啊多多包涵啦。咁啊 ，Houghton 会长喺度嘅，
系
咁啊，又今日有呢个节目咧，就因为多谢 Houghton 会长嘅，阵间解释下啦。咁啊，另外就 Chip Lab 都喺度嘅
，Hello，Hello，Hello。
Chip Lab 就揾嚟帮拖嘅，帮下手嘅。咁咧就嗱，话说本来呢个咧。节目就应该是杰斯频道的清心直说的其中一位嘉宾来的。是啦，咁其实就是 Houghton 会长就有一位朋友啦，好值得访问啦，咁阵间会即介绍下佢背景。咁但係呢就杰斯又因为如果听开 Greg 先节目呢都知道有时屋企人都有事嘅咁样。咁好不幸呢咁佢就要去医院嗰度。係啦，咁所以就嚟唔到。係啦，咁同一时间呢我就觉得呢位嘉宾可能Chip Lab 都有兴趣会一起帮下手。咁所以呢係啦係啦。咁所以就有今日呢个特别嘅节目啦。咁会长。啊，即系你呢位嘉宾系咪识咗好耐嘅咧？
一年到啦，我哋喺外国记者协会度识嘅。
系啦，
咁喺香港嚟讲，一位非常资深嘅外籍记者啦。嗱，佢都香港人嚟噶，都几十年嘅。
嗯，
咁佢就系以前，如果你哋大家有听香港电台以前英文台咧，咁知道有位记者就叫做 Francis Moriarty。
嗯，
啊，咁喺香港都喺，甚至喺香港嘅新闻界都。好多記者朋友都識得去㗎喇。咁我哋傾過好多偈啦，喺外記協會識嘅之後，咁有時食下飯咁呢位先生就佢有好多年嘅採訪經驗啦，咁對香港亦都好有感情。咁佢而家都就最近就都準備計劃就返美國退休啦。佢美國人嚟嘅，來自麻薩諸塞州。咁我都有啲感觸嘅，其實因為唔止佢，其實我認識到好多外國朋友最近呢一兩年都同我講準備就返祖家啦，有啲返英國啊，返美國啊咁樣。咁我都擔心係咪大家都覺得喂係時間 say goodbye 咧對香港咁樣。咁所以都就想訪問下佢，咁睇下對香港啲二十年嘅觀感啦，係咪？因為而家都六月底啦，二十週年，同埋睇下佢對香港啊、對美國啊咁嘅一啲看法啦，咁樣
係咁所以陣間我哋都會，咁當然係英文啦。咁但係咧，應該就嗱，如果傑斯頻道咧，都我相信都唔使擔心嘅，因為我之前都有個訪問嗰個 Matthew Tong 都係用英文啦嚇。咁另外就 Rick 先，如果聽共聚會聽阿 Houghton 會長咧，我哋有時都會請啲外國嘅莊主，咁所以咧都應該冇問題嘅。咁但係可能中間咧有啲有啲論點，可能就要麻煩會長就稍作翻譯一下。咁样
好啊，
好啊，咁我哋正式介绍嘉宾啦，欢迎我哋嘉宾啦，系。
Okay, well, welcome, Francis.
Thank you. Now we go to Night Cam Channel.
Yeah, yeah,
yes.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me here, and it makes it even better that we have a glass of lovely wine.
Yeah,
if we could do this at RTHK, it would be great.
Oh yes, I forgot to mention during the introduction that actually we have a very a glass of very nice Greek wine.
Yeah.
It's called a Retina wine. It's a special wine. It's Retina is not the name of the grape. Okay, it's just made by other a normal local grape from Greece, but they just add a little bit pine raisin during the wine making and make it smell very special.
Mm-hmm. Actually, very pleasant smell.
Very pleasant smell.
Yeah.
And Francis, I just mentioned during the Kennedy introduction, okay, we met at the FCC, the Foreign Correspondent Club.
That's right.
And I did say, I make a remark that recently, not just you, I feel some other expatriate friend, okay, but actually you are Hong Kong geese, I did stress, okay, you live here for, you know, almost... You. More than two decades, you know,
yeah,
you're one of us.
Almost three.
Right. Oh, almost three, yes. Well, and, some people like you recently talked to me that they plan to go back, you know, some go back to the States, some already have gone, some go back to the United Kingdom, or some just retire, maybe down in Malaysia or Thailand. I make a little bit depressing note that, well, is it time that people are going to say goodbye to Hong Kong?
Well, for some people, it's time to say goodbye. I think we're competing for seats with a lot of young students who are deciding whether they want to struggle to make a career in Hong Kong or whether they want to go someplace else.
Yes, that's why we want you to hear you to talk about, you know, how you think of Hong Kong, you know, how to see the world, you know. So anyway, so we are very glad to have you here.
Thank you.
And during the interview, maybe from time to time, I may have a little stop to do some very short Cantonese translation,
like
summarize of
great
what
ideas.
You just said.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
very Hong Kong.
Yeah, I just make a very brief introduction that you're actually from Massachusetts, U.S.
That's true, yeah.
You graduated from a very famous liberal college called the Williams College.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Liberal Arts College, yeah.
Yeah, Liberal Arts College. And then later, is it the journalism have been your whole career, right?
I went to graduate school. I'd already worked as a student. I started working on student papers, and I got a job on my hometown newspaper, which was a very good hometown newspaper, still is, a Pulitzer Prize-winning paper. I started out on the sports desk every morning.
Okay.
I looked up one day on a bulletin board at school because I needed a job. Mm. Well, I already had one job. I was scooping ice cream and washing dishes.
Okay.
And I looked up at the board, and it said someone needed to work on the sports desk at the local paper from 7 o'clock in the morning until 10.
10.
5 days a week.
In the evening.
In the morning.
In the morning,
in the
okay.
morning, right? And I thought, great, because the distance between the office of the newspaper and the at that time I was in a community college, a two-year community college. I transferred later to Williams. I was only a fast five-minute walk. I mean, when you're young, it's a fast five-minute walk. And I thought, great, my first class doesn't start until 10:10. So I've got 10 minutes
so
to make it up and into the class. And that
you can get them quick cash.
I can. Well, they didn't pay me by the day. I got a regular, end of the month, you get a salary or whatever. And I went to work, and I had no particular qualification. In those days, newspapers were very – a lot of newspapers were very ethnically divided. You had people who were politically quite – tended to be quite liberal working on the staff. But the ownership and the high editorial level would be what we call WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. You are familiar with them in Hong Kong. And so there was always a tension between the various ethnic groups that tended to be more liberal and more working class oriented and the ownership. And that was true at a lot of newspapers in those days. That's broken down. That's changed. But when I walked into the sports desk, I looked at the names, and every single guy in the sports department was Irish. And I went to school with two of their kids, and I walked in and we did a little interview, and Mr. O'Gara, who was then the editor, said to me, by any chance, are you Fran Moriarty's son? Now, my name is Francis Moriarty, so there was a good chance, right? And I said, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I am. And he said, okay, your desk is over here. And that's how I got my job. I mean, it was
you bypassed all the interview procedures.
Yeah, there weren't that. I was probably the first guy that walked in after seeing the thing. Mm-hmm. That probably helped, and I showed some initiative, so that gets you something. And I think that's a lesson for me in throughout my whole career is, show the initiative. If you don't do that, it ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
So that's how I got my start, was coming in every morning. I didn't know how to type. I'd never worked on a typewriter. And I was handwriting all of my little things until finally the guys down in the composing room, because in those days the newspapers were actually made with little pieces of lead and printed with paper, right? And the composing room guys sent a message up and said, all right, we've put up with this for a while, but you're going to have to start to learn to type. And my editor said to me, just use two fingers. That's what I do. It's worked for him for 40 years. So I start the two finger. And to this day, I'm basically a two or three finger typist, on my computer. And that was how I started out, writing headlines and writing little sports stories. And there was a guy who sat kitty corner from me in another office. His name was Roger Linscott. He's since passed away. And Roger was a very diligent and very intellectual guy. And he would come in every day with his tie slightly askew and his collar a little open and his jacket. And he would sit down and he had all these reference books. And he was the chief editorial writer. And in a few years after I started working there, he won the Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing in the United States, and that's a big deal.
Well, what story did he do?
He got it not for a single story. He got it for editorial writing. He wrote editorials for the newspaper, and his work was submitted in that category, and he won the Pulitzer Prize. And he was a really nice guy, and I went to school with his daughter as well, and I was just, it was very inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
Very inspiring. People who supported you, they put up with some of your mistakes, they corrected you, but you know, you learned, and you could see, I could see some kind of path in life. And then I got on the school paper, and somehow life just, I never decided to become a journalist, it just kind of came out and got me. You know, like a calling. Some people used to say about the priesthood. You know, many are called, few are chosen. It was a little bit like that. So I kind of stumbled into a career.
Well, it's Moriarty. It's Irish.
Very Irish.
Okay.
And it's the root of many other Irish and even Scottish names. It's a Celtic name. If you say it in the original Celtic, it's about, you know, 3 feet long and almost impossible to pronounce. But the British colonialists did me a favor by anglicizing the name in a simpler way.
Okay.
So we've all experienced similar things at some point.
So we can explain a little bit about what Francis said just now. Francis 都未必话即系好话有志于呢一个记者嘅行业嘅，不过就由于佢以前做 school paper 读书嗰阵时咧，就有一个机会就应征咗一个类似体育记者咁样啦。咁我慢慢就学习即系点样去做啦。咁同埋佢识到一位即系良师益友啦，就系即系负责呢个社论啊，咁可唔可以咁讲 editorial 应该系啦。咁就教导佢点样去做新闻。咁佢就觉得成件事就好似系命中注定，佢行呢条路，食呢行饭咁样。
本来就无心插柳嘅，
系，
咁同埋佢都提过咧，就话嗱，因为嗰度佢来自马萨诸塞州，
系，
即系波士顿嗰度啦，嗰度有好多爱尔兰人，
爱尔兰人系。
但系嗰阵时咧，都个种族，即系始终咧，唔系净系白同黑啊，甚至嗰阵时咧，大部分老细啊，都仲系所谓传统嘅安格鲁撒克逊人嘅，佢哋其实都系睇唔起爱尔兰人，好多时都老细都系安格鲁撒克逊人，即系直接英格兰人嘅啲后裔，咁打工嗰班系爱尔兰人，咁但爱尔兰人嘅思想都系比较
传统
liberal 一啲，即系比较自由派啲，咁传统啲嗰班所谓 wasp 啦，啲安格鲁撒克逊都着数于比较保守共和党一啲，咁所以变咗话佢甚至记者同埋报纸老板之中，从来都有一啲张力嘅，
咁
呢个即系话呢样嘢，其实全世界都系有存在嘅嘢。
We talk about Boston and Irish call these things achievement
spotlight.
Yeah,
spotlight.
I'm not
because about the movie that won a lot of Oscars two years ago.
Yeah, it's my one of favorite movies.
Well, another movie. You remember Good Will Hunting?
That
was based in very also, working class, lower working class areas of Boston.
Okay.
咁最後就話佢嗰陣時佢嗰陣時佢未正式入大學，讀緊社區學院嘅，後來要轉去 Williams College 嘅。咁而嗰陣時帶佢嗰個其中一位編輯都後來攞咗普林茲獎，即係叻人嚟嘅，即係好彩跟到啲好猛嘅人嘅嗰陣時嘅。
So is this your next step? Is AFP after this work?
Oh, no.
Many steps.
many steps. I worked on a local newspaper in what was becoming Silicon Valley. It was still a lot of orchards and farms, beautiful orchards. It's such a shame to see that some of that land has just been paved over. But it was right at the time that chip manufacturers were opening up and everything was changing. It was also at the time when California had instituted laws on environmental impact reports. Very voluminous stuff. And you had to really do a good job filling them out because the state actually took them quite seriously. But they had not yet become resources for reporters. I mean, they were very thick. They were very technical. You had to go through things. And you really had to read the footnotes. And then you go to the page in the back, and it was laborious work. But when you started digging into them, there were great stories.
Mm-hmm.
So the transformation of this beautiful Garden of Eden, it was, you know, with some of the most arable, fertile land in North America, into buildings and parking lots and shopping centers. And I was doing stories about all the things that would happen if you chop down the orchards and how the temperature would raise and the noise levels and how you're going to have to build high walls along the highways and that's going to change your view, et cetera, et cetera. And this helped to bring about a movement in the area of, whoa, let's slow down, let's look, you know, what about these things? And the hearings were getting longer, and the developers hated it. And the ranchers hated it because they could see what was coming. They'd all invested in land elsewhere in California. They'd open up things, giant cooperatives. If you see Sunkist, which I'm sure is a name you're familiar with, that's not actually a company. That's a giant cooperative of growers who've gotten together to form, you know, a way to sell their products. And so I started doing these stories on what the impacts would be on quality of life. And the movement got strong enough that at some point some of the big developers walked into my publisher. It was a weekly newspaper, a very much beloved weekly newspaper. And
that is not in Massachusetts.
No, this is in Silicon Valley, Cupertino.
So you already graduated from Williams College.
I'd already graduated from Williams. I went to Berkeley and got a master's degree in journalism. And one of my classmates who'd gotten a job recommended me to her boss.
That newspaper was based in San Francisco or in South Bay?
In South Bay. Mm. It was a chain of 13 weekly community newspapers. So this is one of the 13. And so after a while, after about a year and a half of this, maybe two, a bunch of the big ranchers and developers walked into my boss's office and said, you're going to have to make a choice. If you want the advertising from the supermarkets and all the advertising that's going to come from the shopping malls that we're planning to build, you know, and you want to be part of the development and share in the money, that's one thing. If you want to keep this guy and keep publishing these stories that we hate, all the ads we're putting into your newspapers are going to walk away.
The same thing happens now
in Hong Kong. So familiar.
It's not new. It's an old story. And he made the business call, which was to sack me.
So the guys are referring to one person, which was you or a group of...
No question. No. It was me.
Okay.
It was me. Yeah.
So reminds us, you know, when in Hong Kong today, the people talking about the Grand Bay Project, Taiwan Kui. I forgot the formal name of it. Okay, I only heard the Chinese Taiwan Kui. That this is the Bay Project.
Yeah,
that already happened in America decades ago.
Yeah, the Bay, the Bay Area, the Greater Bay Area that you call it. Yeah, but it's you have environmental impact reports, EIAs in Hong Kong, and they get reported to some degree. But I tell you, if you dig deep, if you drill deep, there's going to be information in there someplace. Take, for example, the cement tests, we now realize are not just problems with the cement tests. There's problems with a whole bunch of other tests, you know, and what are going to be the implications of that? So that's the kind of stuff in a way that I was working on.
You were talking about 70s when you were in the
This would have been in the 70s, early mid-70s.
So you went to Berkeley in...
I went. I hitchhiked across the United States, as one would in those days, and I arrived in Berkeley in January of 1970, and in the autumn of 71, I enrolled in the journalism graduate school at Berkeley, it was a two-year program, but they encouraged you to try to get out even earlier because it wasn't aimed at creating people who thought about journalism. It was aimed at creating people who worked in journalism. So if you were there more than about five semesters, they would look at you funny. You know, why are you still here? So you had to have a, you had to have a good reason. So I went in, and by 1973, I was working at the Cupertino Courier.
But was it the time where the Vietnam War that draws the most attention?
The Vietnam War was a very, very big issue. I had been active in my student days and graduate days in helping to organize and work and march in, you know, giant protests.
There was, a lot of connection here. Cupertino, you mentioned, this is where Apple is today.
Look, my first story. My first story for the Cupertino Courier was about the fact that Apple had just moved out of its old barn into its first proper offices. Yeah, I knew a lot of those people. And if I understood what was going on, I would be so rich today. You know, I knew the guys that started the first...
You mean the programmer who works with
the guys who founded
Steve Jobs?
The first... I didn't know Jobs. You know, I didn't know Jobs. I'd met one or two other guys there, not Steve. But I knew other people. And I had an offer to be part of the company that built the first computer game. And they took Pong, if you remember. If you don't, Pong is way before your time. It was a game where you – it was like playing ping pong with little things, and you turn the paddles up and down. And they took me out. I knew the guys who created that, and they took me out and showed me their beta version. And it was – they put together old wires and TV things, and the place looked like a junkyard. And they showed me the game, and it just didn't work. You know, the so-called paddles went up and down, and the ball, which was a cursor, would go off the screen. And I said, guys, I don't know what you're trying to do. And they said, yeah, that's why we need you, because we need to explain to other people what we're doing in order to get investment. And I said, I don't get it, but maybe I will if I hang around here. Can you? What are you going to pay? And they said, well, we don't have any money. Well, these guys were in their mid-20s, and they were driving Porsches. And I thought, come on, you got to have some money. I said, I'm not asking a lot. Just give me enough that I can pay my rent and have some food, and we'll see what we can build together. They said, we'll offer you equity. You will be one. There's six of us now. You'll be number seven. And the company was Atari. If that name means anything to you, and I said, if I can't understand it, I can't explain it, and I said no, and that's the stupidest move of my entire life.
Wow, he's interesting.
我哋或者可以講講，係啦，即係七十年代都有好多奇遇啊。
七十年代嘅大灣區計劃，即係而家特首成日話，哇，我哋要學咩三藩市嗰個灣區，就係人哋個大灣區。
東京啊，咁樣啊。
咁嗰陣時本來好多農田嘅，即係嗰陣時啲
好多農社啊嗰啲，係啦，
即係都好多。即係本來係種田嗰啲地主啦，劉乜乜啊、梁乜乜啊嗰種咁嘅人，咁啊揾咗好多錢啦，賣曬啲農田俾啲地產商起商場，好多高科技公司搬嚟，但係產生多好多污染啦。有時做半導體嗰啲好鬼多污染走出嚟，咁佢就係寫好多料嘅嘢。後來就個報紙冇辦法啦，俾啲地產商行入去逼你一定要炒佢，唔係我就抽曬所有廣告，即係啲地產霸權啦，即係加州嘅地產霸權，最後佢就咁樣俾人就炒咗。
咁啊，中間之前即係佢嗰陣就去咗California 嗰邊就即係做呢個份 job 啦。之前佢就去 Berkeley 即係
帕克萊度讀個 master 係傳理系。咁嗰陣時都係六十年代尾七十年代初啦，美國都係風起雲湧。咁前啲可以同佢講啊，喂，究竟佢同香佢所見到香港啲學生運動點樣比較咧？
係同埋頭先亦都 share 過就係喺因緣際會識到。 Apple 一啲好 formative years 嘅一啲人啦。
係啊，
咁啊曾經有即係希望話
邀請佢加入 Apple 嘅。
係啊，同埋即係佢幫手寫一啲文章 promote 下佢哋嘅理念啊等等。咁其實啱啱 Francis 都有個 book 咗個好有趣嘅 point
嘅。錯失良機。
錯失良機嘅就係因為佢都有提出話，即係可能俾一啲可唔可以叫我叫俾啲 shares 定 equity 俾佢。
係啊，股份。
如果佢當時係應承咗嘅話咧，佢而家就會超級有錢啦。
So back to the work, you said so your boss make the business decision to sack you. What was your response at that time? You were very angry or you just planned to leave?
I was very disappointed.
Yeah.
I felt singled out.
Yeah.
I mean, some of my stories ran in some of the other papers, but they all ran with my name on them.
Mm-hmm.
I was hoping, I could think in my heart of hearts, I was hoping that some of my colleagues would stand up for me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
And they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But subsequently, after I left, he began making more business decisions of certain sorts,
mm-hmm.
and they were focused on salaries.
Mm-hmm.
So they tried to form a union mm-hmm. among themselves mm-hmm. to negotiate for higher salaries, mm-hmm. benefits, and he just began sacking them.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, if you had stood up for me,
yeah,
maybe story. It would be a different story.
Yeah,
you could have started, at the very least, you could have started organizing then, but you didn't. You put your heads down,
mm-hmm.
and that's what happens.
Okay, mm-hmm. so you keep on your journalist career?
Yeah, I moved out of the area,
mm-hmm.
And I moved up to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And started freelancing, and I'd already started doing some stuff in the South Bay for a magazine that in mm-hmm. those days was called New West. Mm-hmm. Today it's called California Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
I went up there and started writing more and more, and I became the political editor for Northern California, political writer
mm-hmm.
For Northern California. And it happened to, not too long after I started working there as political editor, under a man named Phil Tracy, who recently passed away and one of the best political journalists from New York City ever, something called People's Temple. Now, older people listening to this will remember. It was a cult. It was headed by Jim Jones, the Reverend Jim Jones, as he called himself, a former monkey salesman, literally, and his wife. And it ended up in the suicide/murders of more than 900 men, women, and children.
In South America.
In Guyana. In South
Guyana,
America,
yeah.
And I did not go to Guyana, but I knew people who did. I knew people who were killed and wounded. Mm-hmm. And I had covered the story in San Francisco. And when the reports of what had happened were coming through, I was at the People's Temple. They had a big fence around the People's Temple at that point to keep people like me away. But there were people from the temple out there watching a television, and the stories came through, and it was very emotional for the people. Some couldn't watch and just walked away. And I began hanging out around the temple, and one day somebody put a box outside that had the word bomb written on it. And I thought, why? If you're going to put a bomb someplace, why would you put it outside your front door? You know, why would you put a bomb outside the front of the temple? It doesn't make any sense. So I looked at it and I thought, I don't think this is a bomb. And I picked it up and I shook the box. And it sounded like something rolling around inside. And I said, crap, this is not a bomb. So I opened it up.
Wow.
Right? I opened it up and I looked inside, and there was a little alarm clock that somebody had wound up and a few batteries or something to float around. It was there was nothing that was going to harm a flea in this thing. And a friend of mine said, I think the Washington Post might be looking for a stringer. Why don't you call him up? So I picked up while I was playing with the box, I called the Washington Post and I said, I just picked up
a bomb.
This thing that says bomb on it outside. But I don't think this is any kind of bomb. Uh-huh. You know, it's got what's in it? I described it again. You know, what was in it? And he said to me, anybody who's willing to pick up something that says bomb on it and shake it is somebody I want to hire. I'll pay you $75 a day and you can be our stringer. And so for the next 4.5 years, I was one of the stringers in San Francisco for the Washington Post.
Oh, for the Washington Post.
Yeah, I made. That's basically how I supported myself.
Okay.
And that was also the era when the whole gay movement in San Francisco was starting up, and I got to know everybody. In that movement very well.
Half a meal.
Harvey was a friend. I got to know him extremely well, and I. Those who saw the film Milk will know.
Yeah, yeah.
The last time I saw Harvey, I knew all the guys. Mm. When I heard that he'd been shot, I jumped in my car. Well, there had been a shooting at City Hall.
Mm.
We didn't know who. possibly the mayor. I called the Washington Post, which had said to me 15 minutes before, we think the People's Temple thing is dying down.
Mm.
Let's give it a rest.
Mm.
15 minutes later, I call him up and say, it ain't over. There's been a shooting at City Hall. I'm on my way. Zoom, I jump in my car. I pull up someplace where you shouldn't park. I run through the door. There's a policeman. And I say, press, I'm on my way upstairs or whatever. And he let me go. So maybe he hadn't got the word yet. I don't know. But he let me through. And I went upstairs and I knew all of the aides who worked for all the members of the Board of Supervisors. And when I walked in, everybody saw me and came over and gave me a big hug. And by that point, I heard on the radio I ran upstairs and the press secretary for the mayor called a press conference in front of the mayor's office and announced that the mayor had been shot and killed. And so I ran down the hallway across the City Hall, San Francisco City Hall. I ran across to the other side and Harvey had been shot. And the policeman was going to stop me inside the door because there was already a cop there. And there were all these guys who said, oh, Francis, and gave me a big hug and all the aides and secretaries and whatever. And Dianne Feinstein, who's now the senator, for one of the senators from California in the United States Senate, she was then a member of the Board of Supervisors, and her office was, as soon as I walked in, she saw me. And I said, hi, Dianne, and whatever. And the door to Harvey's office was next to her. And the door was open. And I looked, and I could see Harvey had very big feet. And I looked, and I could see his feet sticking up from behind his desk. And I was going to walk in. I mean, I'm a reporter. I want to see this scene, right? Even though he's my friend, and he's just, I got to see this. And I start to walk in, and Dianne Feinstein caught my glance. And she knew what I was going to do. And she immediately, by that point, she'd gotten up from her desk and come out to the door. And when she caught my eyes, she reached over and grabbed the door of Harvey's office and pulled it closed. And that's the last time I ever saw Harvey Milk.
这个真系好好大转折嘅两件事啦，两件事啦。头先就讲紧有关人民性电教，咁啊，原来阿 Francis 都系有追过呢个新闻嘅。咁啊，可能简单少少讲一讲啦，就系、一个都可以话系邪教啦吓。当时有一个叫做牧师叫 Jim Jones 去领导嘅
中师教派，
系啦。咁就去到80年代就成个教派好多人就移民咗去南美基内亚一个地方度，咁结果就发生一个好。集体自杀的一件事好轰动，当年好轰动的一件事。
你到八十年代七几年？
七几年系啦。咁就阿 Francis 有追过呢、这个，
都讲过啦。系即系执到个盒。系其实嗱，呢样嘢我真系讲到话讲。下次见到个盒，使唔使要同胞物尽？唔好真系执啊！吓，尤其是各位啲港女，一到暑假去伦敦、巴黎 shopping 咧，唔好随便执嗰啲盒啊！急死咁好危险嘅，呢啲人唔好随便模仿。
吓，就系讲啊，当时即系 Francis 都好啊，艺高人胆大，见到一个咁嘅 boxes， 即系轰大家系一个炸弹咁，但系佢又。唔覺得係啲咩嘢？
而家千祈唔好模仿。
Audience don't imitate your act or opening that box, especially in London and Paris today.
No, today I would think twice about it. Yeah, but it just looked
啊，咁头先系咧，佢就话其实好流嘅，睇落去就好流。咁佢熬，咁但系呢件事都令到佢有个工作上嘅契机，咁就系咁啱咧，喺呢件事即系发生咗之后咧，就Washington Post 嗰边咧就即系揾佢咁样，系啦。咁佢就啱啱话我十五分钟之前咧先啱啱喺一个疑似炸弹嘅 boxes 先搞过佢嚟，咁结果都冇事。咁对方就话
系啦，
我哋好需要一个好似你咁勇咁够僵吓，可以连炸弹都敢掂嘅人，于是即刻请咗佢。咁之后嗰四年咧，佢就代表 Washington Post 就喺San Francisco 嗰边就做一个 correspondent 咁样。咁中间亦都有件事就系关于Heavy Milk 嘅一个行刺嘅事件啦。
Heavy Milk 就大家可能睇翻，搵翻自己搵 CD 睇啦，
搵翻套
DVD 啦。Milk 就讲嗰时嗰啲同志运动，咁一个同志运领袖做到三藩市市议会嘅议员嘅，争取多好多同志权益，咁啊俾人。喺美國好多時都係講到俾阿爸咁嘅關，
係啦，槍殺咗。
咁佢就係有直接喺現場吸。係
啦，佢同阿 Harvey Milk 本身亦都識嘅，因為就 Francis 就追好多有關當年 Gay Movement 即係同志平權嘅一啲運動，本身私人私底下都同佢有交情。
尤其是而家香港呢個同志平權都係好大嘅 topic 咧，尤其早之前台灣至咩 pass 咗承認同志婚姻嘅嘢，而家都係一個。
係，
但喺美國嚟講就已經係六七十年代就已經開始呢樣嘢。
Harvey was the first openly gay politician. And well, I think there was one woman elsewhere who was a lesbian, but not well known at all. And so he was the first major openly gay person. And had he lived, no question, he would have been at least the next mayor of San Francisco. And from there...Who knows?
Yeah, right. Maybe.
But he once said to me in one of our, maybe not our last conversation, but very close to the last conversation, we were sitting in City Hall having a talk, and he said, you know, people like me should really never achieve power. And I said, why? He said, because we're radicals, we're revolutionaries, we're reformers. And we're very passionate. And when we achieve power, we then want to implement all the things that we've been fighting for. And he said, we can become, like dictators. If that should happen. But he saw himself very clearly as the...at the point of a spear of a movement.
Okay.
So after 4 years at the Washington Post?
4.5 as a stringer.
Then what's your next move?
Well, it's funny. A girl that I had dated at university and had stayed, we'd broken up. She wanted to live in Europe. She liked Germany. She studied German. Okay. So...I was very disappointed because I liked her a lot. We're still friends. And out of the blue, she sent me an advertisement that she'd cut out of a newspaper or magazine, all in German. And I had studied a little German at school, but not enough to read that ad. And she put a note on it that said, I don't think your German is good enough to read this ad. But it sounds...like this is meant for you. So she translated it, and it was for a journalism fellowship program in Paris at the it's kind of hard to describe the name in English, but it's for people who are a center for people who are already journalists to learn new skills and have new opportunities. Say in French, it's CFPJ, CFPJ. I applied, and to my great surprise, got accepted. I was near the deadline, and I thought, well, it's never going to happen. So I said, but no, they sent me a letter and said, you know, be here in March, because it's a one-year program that starts in the autumn. We have French language training because everything is in French. So you've got to come here
earlier
and start working on your French. And so it coincided the socialist François Mitterrand had just been elected.
麦特朗,
yeah, had just been elected president of France. And so I rolled into town very quickly after that election. So it was a very interesting time to be in France, and it was a great fellowship program. I got to travel to Lebanon and Israel and Egypt and, and Germany and East Germany and all around Ireland, and it was just a fabulous experience.
Wow. Egypt.
Yeah.
East Germany.
I went to East Germany. I was in Egypt. Well, what happened was at that time, coincidentally, Sadat, the head of Egypt, had been assassinated.
Yeah.
And Mubarak had taken over.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. People suspected Gaddafi of involvement because the first news outlet in the world to break the story of Sadat's assassination was Radio Libya.
Mm-hmm.
And we were monitoring Radio Libya in French when we heard the story.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, as part of the Camp David Accords that had been reached between Israel and Egypt, Israel agreed to return the Sinai Peninsula, a pretty big piece of turf, to Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got down there, I went to Israel first and did some stories in Israel and filed for the Washington Post. And then to the bureau chief there. And then I went to, via Cyprus, that's how you had to do it, to go to Cairo. And I saw the ceremony where Mubarak laid a wreath at the place where Sadat was buried. And I never saw a more nervous man in my life. When he laid the wreath and stepped back in line with everybody else, and he was still alive, you could see him breathe a sigh of relief. So I covered that story. Then I went to Lebanon, and we expected that the Israelis were going to invade. And so I waited in Lebanon, and I was spending a lot of my own money, which I didn't have a lot of. I had some money from a stipend from the scholarship fund, the fellowship, but I was kicking in my own as well, staying at the Commodore Hotel, the famous Commodore Hotel, now gone, and waiting for the Israelis to invade because that was the rumor and that would be a hell of a story. So I waited and waited, and my money was getting low, and I saw an article in, I think, Le Monde in French, and by this guy who seemed to know what was going on. He was a good reporter. Referring to the Israeli invasion that now looks like it's not going to happen, and I thought, well, these guys know more than I do. You know, I can't wait to run here forever. So I was driven to the airport, which was it had been shot up terribly. How they kept it running, I don't know. It was just a wreck. It was a bombed, shot up wreck of an airport, and. Flew out, I had to go back to Cyprus in order to, get back to Israel. And when I got to Paris, I caught the flight from Israel to Paris. And when I got there, I opened up the newspaper in the Israelis.
And the invasion.
And the Israelis had invaded. Uh-huh. So my timing was
so
not
you're really
good,
unlucky.
But it was a great, great fellowship. And it had been organized by a man named Philippe Vianney, a visionary, who was one of the left-leaning intellectuals, journalists, that came out after World War II when the old order was destroyed. Mm-hmm. And he and his friends were responsible for creating a lot of the press that exists in French today, Nouvelle Observateur, the people who went to work for Le Monde, et cetera, et cetera. And a remarkable individual who saw the need for having people from around the world come and see Europe and see it in a holistic way.
Yeah.
Because the European community was still quite new. It had not become the European Union. And it was an economic union first before it became anything else. So we were really there to experience and see this vision of a Europe that wasn't fighting but was united. And that was really what he wanted us to experience and have. He knew if you experienced something personally, it would stay with you for your life. You would keep an interest. So he developed, through this program, Journalists in Europe, a network of people still in touch with each other through Facebook and other means, from just about every place in the world you can think of, who have had this European experience and for whom these Brexit stories today and the Macron.
Macron,
the new French president. We have a connection, in a way, an emotional connection, because it's part of your life with what's happening today. So he was a man who was looking decades into the future.
Yeah. So all had been done in 1 year only, you mean the fellowship?
A year and plus the 6 months that I spent learning French.
But you have been traveling almost half of the world for all those incidents.
And a lot of things happening there.
Yeah, there were so many things happening. So many things happening. I went to Ireland, went to Northern Ireland, went to Belfast, and was taken by taxi to the Protestant sector and met Protestant Unionists, and taken to the Catholic sector and met members of the Irish Republican Army, the IRA. I had experiences like that. I spent a lot of time in Germany. I got to know West Berlin very well, and I got to know East Berlin. I had some amazing experiences in East Berlin. I got hooked into the dissident community, which was linked to religious people who had links between East and West. Oddly enough, when I came to Hong Kong in 1989, I arrived on the day, April 14th, that Hu Yaobang died. And I woke up in the morning and there was the first headline. And maybe I should throw in that when I was at Berkeley, because I'd already worked as a journalist, they didn't make me take all the courses. So they said, you can study something else. So to make a long story short, I started studying Asian nationalism and the rise of Chinese Marxism and communism, right? So I already had a little interest in background. So I get here, I'm working at AFP, Tiananmen Square happens. By November, I'd only been working there 7 months. I had huge amounts of vacation time because of so much overtime. So I get on the airplane because it's going to be my mother's 65th birthday. And I'm going to fly back to the United States. I got time, I got money, okay, I'll do it. So I get the cheapest flight I can that goes through Bahrain or Qatar or someplace, and then to Frankfurt before going to Paris. So we get to Frankfurt, and we're sitting on the tarmac for the longest time, and I hear my name called. And I go, why would anybody call me? It must be somebody else. I've misunderstood. A couple of days later, Mr. Moriarty, please tell the phone and bring your things. What is this about? And then the curtain opens, and the stewardess says, Mr. Moriarty? I go, yeah. She goes, come with me. And calls me up to the front of the airplane. And I say, what's this all about? And suddenly there's a gaggle of stewardesses standing around me. And one of them says, we know that you're a journalist. I don't know how they knew. I don't know how they knew. She said, we know that you're a journalist, and we think you might like to get off the airplane here. I said, well, I'm going to Paris and then to New York. Why would I want to get out of the airport, get out of the plane in Frankfurt? She said, because they're tearing down the wall, and we think you might want to go. Timing.
Yeah.
Is everything.
Of course, you gladly oblige to this offer.
Now that's and the go funny, to that's the. I was waiting to see if you would ask that. Yeah. I thought, no, my mother, you can't cover every story in the world. I've just had working intimately with the desk on Tiananmen Square, although I was in Hong Kong. I covered the big demonstrations in Hong Kong. I was a new guy on the desk, so they sent me out. And that's when I met all of the big figures in the pro-democracy movement and figures in government and all that. And that was the real beginning of my link with Hong Kong, because I saw all these people, million people, marching twice. And they're, old ladies struggling in wheelchairs and kids in strollers and people carrying their babies, not saying a word, completely silent. The only thing you can hear is the feet on the road. And I thought, Yeah.
What kind of protest is that?
I thought this is really amazing. Mm. These people are really amazing. And what they're feeling is super sincere. Mm. So I covered every demonstration, the imposition of martial law in the number 8 typhoon, all that kind of stuff. And I was at that in front of the New China News Agency when, I remember Gary Chiang Kai-nam.
Chiang Kai-nam. Right, who became the
second number 2 in the DAB party later on.
Mm.
He stood up. He took the microphone out of Chiu Meng Kuang's hands and yelled, "Downward Li Peng."
Yeah. He almost
I was shocked. So it's raining. It was a typhoon. It was a real typhoon.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to write my notes, and I don't have any. And people started. Chiu Meng Kuang said, "Let's show our solidarity with the people in Beijing.
Mm.
Put down your umbrellas, take the hoods off your jackets, and stand in the rain." For 1 minute.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Hong Kong people don't like to get their heads wet.
Yeah.
You know, but everybody took it off and stood there in the rain. And I'm trying to take notes. I still have the notebook with all the water stains on it. And suddenly, there's umbrellas opening up over me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, it's okay. I can, you know, somebody said, no. We want you to tell our story.
Yeah.
And at that moment, I knew.
You have to stay here.
This was my commitment. I identified with this very strongly, and I thought, you know, these people's story is really important and deserves to be told. So that's the beginning for me. So anyway, to finish your story, get back to New York.
Okay,
I get back to New York. Mm. My mother's waiting for me, and she's standing with her arms crossed, looking very stern. And I said, "Mom, you don't look very happy to see me." She said, "I didn't think I'd see you here. I thought, I know my son. He's going to go to Berlin and bring his mother home a piece of the wall."
Wow.
But I failed. But what saved me, was I brought her a little statue of the goddess of democracy.
Oh, okay.
And she'd been watching all of this on TV. And when she saw the statue of the goddess of democracy, she went, "Okay, I'll take that in place of a piece of the wall." I was okay.
咁啊，終於都去到啊 ，Francis 去到同香港嘅聯繫啦。咁啊，我哋使唔使唞一唞？
唞一唞。嗱，好嘅。咁啊，休息之前咧，我哋好快就再譯翻一啲嘢先。啊，我哋嘉賓講咗好多嘢啦 ，Francis。咁就有啲 point 我哋謝師都認唔切啦。
係。
總之又哇，謝師個 session 其實好精彩嘅。本來唔係我諗住訪問即係問嘅嘢，咁但係就佢講咗好多佢自己個人嘅一啲 history 啦咁樣。咁啊，有一點就話佢喺法國攞咗個資助啦，
呢個資助啦 ，fellowship 一個。
咁就去咗喺歐洲好多地方，同埋中東好多地方做採訪啦。包括又去咗德國啦、東德啦，
去過黎巴嫩啦，
去過東柏林啦，咁去黎巴嫩啦、
埃及啦。
咁嗰時埃及就係阿薩達特總統俾人殺咗啦，咁佢直係有採訪去葬禮嘅。咁我哋諗住佢葬禮冇咩啫，有咩好採訪啫？但係佢話唔係嘅，見到好多嘢嘅，就係因為嗰個薩達嗰個繼任人阿穆巴拉克好緊張嘅喺個婚嗰個葬禮嗰度，佢直情係一直拎住花圈好緊張，到放低個花圈退翻入去啲人群裏邊咧，佢自叫鬆翻口氣，即係佢驚佢一個人行出嚟攞住花圈咧，係一個好容易俾人槍殺嘅 target 嚟嘅，係好緊張嘅嘢。好啦，咁就另外又都再早啲佢提過佢自己再後生嘅時候，就謝師講咩美國嘅大灣區計劃啦。咁喺呢個 Silicon Valley South Bay 即係南灣區嗰度咧，就 Cupertino 就係即係而家蘋果電腦總部啦，就幫一間一隻叫 Cupertino Courier 嘅一份報紙咁啊，做實習記者啦，跟住好多大佬啦咁樣。咁佢有提過就係話佢。
同几个
都好似都唔实习记者啦，嗰阵时已经吓，
佢其实后屘就
当一面揭露好多嘢噶啦，咁就某啲原因就系俾啲
大财团啊，附近喺商场嘅一啲即系商人啦吓，咁行入去佢 office 度，就要求佢同佢讲话，如果嗱你想继续我哋落广告嘅话咧，咁你就要查呢个人啦。
咁总之就系话佢基本上个报纸都系商业决定啦，咁去喐佢，咁佢就系话佢自己个人感受啫，即系喐佢都明咩 事嘅，但係就話嗰陣時佢好多同事都冇乜點幫佢出聲，或者幫佢申訴嚇。咁、即係佢覺得就係話，而後來嗰份報紙嘅發展冇幾耐，連佢批同事都冇埋份工啊，剁埋啦。
係啊，
咁佢即係話有時一啲你一啲周圍嘅事，有時你以為係事不加關己，見到有啲人俾個制度蝦緊、恰緊嗰陣時，你唔企出嚟同佢發聲。
系到最后咧，你又会遭殃嗰时咧，
你自己都遭殃嘅时就
冇人
帮
你
啦，咁就系呢个一个教训嚟嘅咁样。OK，
咁啊，即系翻嚟正式听下佢同香港之间发生啲咩故事啊？好。
来为伴的那份乱之和宴。